Well, it's nice to be back. And I want to spend a little time with an introduction that comes from John Dillenberger, who is a recognized historian on church history matters. What John Dillenberger says about the issue of women in the community of faith is this: we tend to think it's our issue. We tend to think that the relationship of women to the faith community, both good and not so good, is something that is somehow only current. And therefore, he suggests to us that we need to get the broad expanse of the role of women in the Judeo-Christian tradition from the very beginnings of that tradition. So what I'm going to do this morning is attempt to do that. And ironically, I'm going to start with two illustrations. One that comes from a book that is simply entitled Hamilton in Jefferson. It's written by Peter Onoff. And in that book, he talks about how it was that Thomas Jefferson, after years of culturalization in Virginia and, of course, in the early development of the colonies, he went off to France. He liked France. He enjoyed France. He liked the literature. He enjoyed the people. But he had one issue. He found the women in France to be too pushy. And he wrote about that extensively. It was really a complaint that he registered over and over again to the constant agitation of the French. And he was once asked what he thought about women in France. And he said those women needed to come to the colonies to learn about their place. So just tuck that away. Here's the second illustration. It has to do with a fellow whose name was George Kelsey. George Kelsey was an ethicist. He was Martin Luther King's doctoral dissertation advisor, distinguished professor of ethics at Boston University. He came to Drew University, where I was studying, and I was privileged, really, to get a class card to get into one of his seminars. George Kelsey was indeed a mountain of a man. He had an imposing physical presence. He loved to chew cigars. He had a vast knowledge of his discipline, and he communicated with great expertise. I remember a couple of things that George Kelsey taught us. The first one was this: your ethics are what you do by yourself in the dark. And the second thing he taught us was this: speaking from the point of view of African Americans and women, perhaps the most segregated hour in all of American culture is 11 o'clock on Sunday morning, when in that time the great majority of the Protestant tradition met for worship. And so, with those two concepts in mind, I think it brings us to the history of the Christian community, and even before that, the history of the Judeo-tradition. And as we look at that tradition, we see some very interesting patterns. It is quite clear that both of those traditions grow up out of cultures that had very, very negative, confining views of women. Women had a place. In some of the better places, they resided on pedestals. And if you think about that, that wouldn't be very comfortable, would it? And yet, running through all of those traditions, you find some very interesting stories about women. For example, the Lord God called to Abram, "Come out of the Ur of the Chaldees and found a nation." And so for centuries now, pretty much the theological world has paid homage to Abraham, the father of us all. But what about Sarah, his wife? Well, I think she was really a person of significant strength. For don't you remember how it was that as that journey began and continued on through Egypt land, what did Abram do about describing the identity of his spouse? He took her aside and he said, "Sarai, we're in a dangerous country. you're a very attractive woman. If they find out that you are my wife, they'll kill me so that someone can marry you. And so, Sarai, I'd like for you to pretend that you are my sister. And that is exactly what that woman did. She agreed to those terms. And in order to agree to those terms, she actually was caught up in Pharaoh's harem. And she endured that with strength and integrity. Why? Out of a sense of loyalty to the mission, establishing a nation. Oh yes, and there's more. Sarah was barren. And as she reached older age, she realized that Abram needed a son. And she gave her permission to Abraham to be intimate with Hagar, a union that produced Ishmael. And it was Sarai who very much tried to provide for that extended family acceptance and meaning. And of course, Sarai was ultimately the mother of Isaac, who became the father of Jacob and Esau. And yet we don't talk much about her, do we? It's all about Abram. Oh, and there's another woman. I'm very close to this woman because when I was in grad school, we had to take a test examining our knowledge of the English Bible. In the particular group with which I was associated, 61% of us failed. And it was a little embarrassing to the university. And one of the questions on that exam, I'll never forget it, and the horror with which I read it. Who was the mother of Moses? Anybody know? Thank you so much for being a part of the 61% of the class of 1961 that failed the English Bible knowledge. Well, her name was Jochebed. And if you think about this woman, you got to think about a couple of things. Number one, she was a slave. And what that means is she had felt the wrath of Pharaoh. She had seen her fellow Israelites slain and abused in the field. Everything was stacked against her. And the possibilities that she experienced for not only her own life, but the life of her children were extraordinarily limited. And what did she do? The first thing she did was devise a plan, and the interesting thing about the plan was, Daddy isn't mentioned in it at all. And part of the plan was to construct a vessel that would have about it buoyancy. And into that vessel she placed that child, Moses. And she knew that she herself could not be a part of raising him as a surrogate. And so she arranged for her daughter to have the access to achieve that purpose. Oh, but there's something more about this woman. She was a Levite. And what that meant was she was aware of the tradition out of which she and her family had come. She knew all the stories and all the traditions. And have you ever wondered how it was that Moses came into contact with his tradition? Bernard Anderson, in his book, Understanding the Old Testament, answers the question pretty boldly. It was his mother who saw to it that he learned the stories and passed them along. And then let's move a bit forward into the era of the judges in Israel. These were people who were responsible for making social commentary on the times in which they lived. They were also responsible for saying, look, what we need to do is that rather than this. Most biblical historians agree on a simple fact about the judges. Perhaps one of the finest, perhaps the best judge that Israel ever produced was a woman whose name was Deborah. And you might remember the story. The Israelites were engaged in a great struggle, and they were trying to find their identity. And finally, Deborah went to Barak, one of their generals, and said, you need to attack Sisera. Sisera was a renowned battle man. He was a warrior. He was fierce. He was violent. And Barak said, no, not me. And then he made a fatal mistake. He said, the only way I'm going to engage Sisera is if you go with me. Revealing all of his sexism. A woman wouldn't go into battle. But he picked the wrong lady to say that to. And as a result, Deborah went with Barak, engaged Sisera, defeated him soundly, and then shared with her general this interesting sentence. It's in the book of Judges, by the way. This is the first battle in which the victory was shared with a woman. I just lift up those three illustrations to suggest to you that coming out of the Old Testament, there is ample evidence that while that culture was misogynistic in every way possible, there were these islands of strength. Sarah, certainly Jochebed, certainly Deborah, and then there's always Ruth. Women who were very much a part of the emerging tradition of the Jewish people. And so let's take a look at the New Testament. When we look at it, once again, we're faced with the dichotomy that we find there. For there's no doubt about it. First century Christianity grew up in a misogynistic culture. There are numerous references in the New Testament that sexists are often happy to make us aware of. The great one is by St. Paul. If a woman has something to say about the church, tell her husband. And then he'll take it over to the church. And we are aware that there were only 12 disciples, and they were all men. But what we miss in terms of nuance, initially in the New Testament, is the relationship of Jesus to women. Do you ever think about this? Hallelujah! Christ is risen! Hallelujah! On the first morning, those words may have been sung. Where were all the guys? Hiding. They were back in Jerusalem, the door locked. And who was it that went to that tomb early on? Yes, to provide a service of entombment, but to do that at enormous risk. It was Mary and the other Mary as they journeyed through the darkness of pre-dawn Jerusalem to be a part of that first awareness of the risen Christ. And as you look at Jesus, it's quite clear that Jesus understood and responded to women. Don't you remember the widow's mite? That's not a financial story. That's the story about a teacher standing in a temple and seeing all the males standing around with their little bits of money. And how it was that this lowly widow came in and put in her simple gift. And Jesus called attention to that. The presence of Jesus in the context of the question of the role of women is very clear. He advocated that. He empowered that. And we find great evidence of that in an interesting book that is called An Apocryphal Gospel. One of your people who teaches at Princeton University, Elaine Pagel, she's a New Testament scholar. She has done enormous research on this Gospel of Mary. And here's the first question she raises. It's a pretty solid theological book. It talks about the meaning of Jesus as a Messiah. It talks about the essence of the kingdom, not as a political reality, but as a spiritual phenomenon. And her question is this: why was it, when the canon was closed, this very substantial, profound theological piece was excluded? Her conclusion is this: that apocryphal book is called the Gospel of Mary. And by the time the canon was closed, the authorship in the New Testament was pretty much a good old boys club. But the church was not finished with Mary Magdalene. Today, if you ask the average person who was Mary Magdalene, there's a good chance you're going to hear back that she was a Reformed prostitute. Well, that's not totally true. It is true in the Gospels that are a part of the canon that she was a woman who Jesus freed from a demon. But may I remind you that prostitution was not the only demon available to people in the first century. Demons like depression, demons like anxiety, demons like feelings of inferiority, they were all present in that world. So when we read the word, Jesus freed her from this demon, why do we leap to the fact that she was a prostitute? I'll tell you why, and this is just history. I'm indebted to Elaine Pagel for it. That's the work of the fourth century church. By that period of time, the church had become male-dominated. The whole structure of the clergy was all about men, and I'll say a word about that in just a moment. And so the Vatican actually took action to pronounce Mary Magdalene to have been a prostitute, and thus we live with that mythology even to today. But what does scholarship reveal about her? Well, in the Gospel of Mary, it suggested that Mary was a very strong contributor to the work of Jesus and the disciples. You do know, of course, Jesus was a nomad. He wandered through Israel of his time, counting on others to provide for him. And it is clear that Mary felt a commitment, not out of obligation, but out of support, and that she was a very constant contributor to the well-being of Jesus. We also know that she was the disciple that Jesus loved the most. And in the Gospel of Mary, there is a very clear picture of Peter. Remember him? Peter, the guy who preached the Pentecost. Peter, who was the fisherman. But also Peter, who said, "I don't know that guy." And also Peter, who was a kind of a loud, offensive individual. A man who had to be questioned over and over again by Jesus. "Do you love me?" In the Gospel of Mary, it is quite clear that Peter had strong feelings about Mary Magdalene. And the fact that somehow Jesus preferred her. And of course, there are those around who like to make the suggestion that that was a sexual relationship. There's nothing in those Gospels that suggests that. The suggestion of scholarship is this. She was an equal to Jesus. She was a colleague with Jesus. And in the early church, she was a strong voice for the structure, not only of the organization, but the very nature of the gospel itself. And so I would encourage you to read Elaine Pagel's book, The Gospel of Mary. And I'd also encourage you to examine some of the documents of the 4th and 5th century that went out of their way to make sure that Mary was not perceived as the strong leader individual in the early church that clearly she was. Oh, and there are other women in the New Testament church. In fact, John Gotze, a historian, suggests one of the things we overlook from time to time is this. By the year 300 AD, as best we can determine, the majority of Christians in the world were in fact women. In fact, there is a pagan Greek philosopher who complains about that, saying that the Christian movement was all about women as over and against the totality of human life. We also know about a woman whose name was Lydia of Philippi. She was a financier. Hey, Lydia, according to the book of Acts, was probably the first chairperson of a stewardship campaign in the life of the church. She knew how to raise bucks, and she was good at it. There's also a woman there who was very much a part of the establishment of the church at Corinth. Her name was Priscilla. She resided in Rome. She was Jewish of origin. And she was a person who gave direction and meaning and dimension to the early church at Corinth. And also, you must remember that it is during this first 300 years of the church's life that we established the role of the deacon. And if you look at the hierarchy, your guy Calvin used this in his the definition of the church, right? Sure. He talked about there first was the clergy. And then there were the teachers. And then there were the elders that made up the consistory. And then there were the deacons. And if you look at the role of the deacon, you realize that it was right there that the reality of the gospel hit the road. For while it was that the clergy and the elders were worried about who was legitimately receiving communion, and while it was that the teachers were charged with making sure that Calvin's ideas were implemented in the life of the church, it was deacons, mostly women, who cared for the orphaned, the old, the sick, the abandoned, and provided what we today might call the social arm of the church. I think if you rank those with a kind of objectivity, you're going to realize deacons were very important, and that role begins in the early church. We also know that women played a very critical role in the initial celebration of the Eucharist, the Holy Supper. Contrary to what communion is today, the Eucharist meal began simply as a meal, not dissimilar from the whole Passover tradition. And people would gather in homes, and they would break bread together. And it was in the commonality of this broken bread and the shared cup that the Eucharistic tradition developed. Guess who was really a part of the leadership of the early Eucharistic communities? You got it. Women. They were charged with the responsibility of making that happen. And of course, while all of that was occurring, we have to deal with St. Paul, who was clearly a sexist. Some people go so far as to say that Paul was probably one of the best illustrations of a control freak you're going to find anywhere. And he begins to write, if a woman has something to say. And after a while, there were some people that came along that adopted and gave credence to that notion. For example, there was a guy with the name of Origen. And he acknowledged that every now and then you bump into a woman who has some knowledge about the faith. He actually acknowledged that. Isn't that great? But he also said that when you meet a woman who is able to prophesy, she must not do that in the assembly, but tell someone. And they bring it to the assembly. There was a guy by the name of Tertullian, and he took a very strong stance against women doing anything of a sacramental nature. He wrote that women are not to teach, they're not to preach, they're not to baptize, and they are not to be leaders in the life of the early church. And as that sort of caught on, and don't misread what I'm about to say now, I'm not suggesting that the issues of women within the church is a Catholic issue. That's not my point. My point is that as the concept of Catholicity in the Vatican and the notion of the papacy began to take shape, what we see here is the cementing of these concepts that were against women. The church became a male function. The priest did everything. And to show you how insidious that kind of thinking can become, at first it was because the priests were men that they did everything. And women were subjugated to lower levels of involvement. But it was only a couple of years, centuries maybe, until all lay people were put into those roles of being subjugated to the priest. And so when you went to church, what did you do? You watched the priest. He did it all. And women were a part of that kind of bias. And that brings us up to the Reformation period. Was it? Yeah. Yeah.
Would the Catholic Church be without the nuns?
I think the Catholic Church would be in a much better position if they did not heed the nuns more frequently. I don't have a lot of knowledge. Barbara is much more knowledgeable about that because of her work at Seton Hill. But I do know this about nuns. They tend to be much more open than do priests. They tend to be much more sensitive, much more inclusive, and much more thoughtful as such. Now, that doesn't mean every nun is all of those things, but I'm speaking now categorically. So the Catholic Church, I think, has missed a great opportunity by not... I might as well say that. I think they've missed a great opportunity by not ordaining women, first of all, and by ultimately relegating nuns to just a slightly lower level. You're called to the priesthood, but you accept the vocation. So, nuns play a critical... Where would Catholic education be without nuns? Where would many of the Catholic services be without nuns? They are the social conscience, I think, of the Roman Catholic. Now that you have to be careful not to speak categorically, but there's no question about it that they are pivotal. I'm sorry, I've been ignoring your question.
You said that their role is very limited. The role of the nuns is clearly a top.
You got it. And the best way to define that was, 30 years ago, Pope John Paul came to this country. And you maybe remember he was down in Georgetown at the cathedral, and there was a very strong, well-spoken, bright, well-educated nun who stood up and asked the Pope when the church was going to ordain women. He never responded to that, but his body language said it all. Never looked up, never responded, just sat there. So you're absolutely right. The sexism, and we don't want to, I'll get to this in a moment, but we don't want to lay sexism totally on the Roman Catholic Church, because we have plenty of that to go around to as well. As we move into the Reformation era, we discover a guy by the name of Martin Luther. What's interesting to me about Martin Luther, in addition to his 95 theses and the work that he did that obviously facilitated the development of Protestant thought, one of the very first things he did after kind of the Reformation took shape and became kind of institutionalized, he married a nun. Her name was Catherine von Bora. And Catherine von Bora is credited with beginning and developing the whole concept of the kindergarten, which in German means a garden for the children. She's also credited by her husband in his book entitled Table Talk with the development of what it means to be a Christian family. So that when we talk about the Reformation, of course, Luther's role is paramount. But isn't it interesting that probably the closest advisor, the closest colleague that he really had was Catherine von Bora. And that when you read the real history, not the pseudo-history, you discover that this woman was integral in terms of making sure that the church was mindful of children, developing educational programs. And any time the Christian community in today's world celebrates the festival of the Christian home, we need to take our hat off and acknowledge that it wasn't Luther, it was Catherine von Bora. Also during this time, unfortunately, one of your guys, John Calvin, made a bad statement. He said that, in fact, a woman's place was in the home. And I think that was sad and unfortunate, maybe taken out of context, but it occurs too frequently not to realize it may have been part of his thinking. But during the Reformation era, we begin to see the very the development of the role of women in the life of the faith community. Which brings us then up to the 18th century, a time that I'm kind of interested in and want to spend some time with this morning. And we want to look at a woman whose name was Susanna Wesley. unapologetically, she's one of the heroes of my denomination, but more than that, she's a woman of enormous importance. Why? Well, she gave birth to 19 children. Unfortunately, only 10 of them survived. But of the 10 that survived, every one of them was homeschooled by that woman. And two of those men, John and Charles Wesley, went off to Oxford University, where they distinguished themselves as scholars. And John Wesley became the social conscience of the church in England, giving birth to the now the United Methodist Church that went around the world. His brother Charles is accredited with over 6,000 hymns. And it is said by historians of a secular nature that John Wesley saved England from the horrors of the revolution that beset France during that same period. So we see in Susanna Wesley an enormously significant individual. And when you put her up against her husband, Samuel, there's no contest. Samuel was appointed to go to the Epworth Church. If you ever go to England and you go to Epworth, you'll feel sad for that poor guy. It's nothing but marsh and swamp and bad smells. And they appointed him there. And they left him there for 38 years. That's not an appointment, that's a sentence. He was also a guy who was in and out of jail because of dumb, stupid things that he said and did. He was also a man who was in debt. And this is what he did for fun. He tried to write the New Testament in rhyme. Could you tell me why? It doesn't take very much awareness to realize that Samuel Wesley was not the sharpest pencil in the box. And anything good that grew up out of that family and home, which was obvious, clearly was at the hand of Susanna. And I just add this as a footnote. Not only did she teach her kids how to read and write and understand history, she taught them the Bible and questions of faith, to the point that John Wesley, as an adult and as the leader of the Methodist movement in England, was among the first to raise questions about subjugating women to roles of inferiority. It was John Wesley who, as he rewrote the Anglican service of marriage and sent it off to America, eliminated from the vow spoken by the woman to love, honor, and obey, he struck the word obey and said that the vow between a husband and a wife should celebrate equality. So when you talk about the 18th century England and 18th century development of Methodism, of course, Wesley's in the forefront. But his mother was indeed a leader. There were other women a part of the Methodist movement that were equally important. One was called Barbara Heck. She lived in New York City. She was a woman of means. Her parents, her father had been an importer. And a fellow by the name of Philip Embury was asked by John Wesley to come to New York City and to preach the gospel and establish the church. When Mr. Embury got here, he was overwhelmed. I always find that interesting. He was overwhelmed by the task. And it was Barbara Heck who encouraged, supported, directed, and ultimately enabled Philip Embury to preach the first Methodist service in the city of New York, to the extent that historians now credit Barbara Heck as being the mother of Methodism in America. Kind of an interesting statistic. Oh, and here's another story. It had to do with a woman whose name was Jerina Lee. She was an African-American woman. She had been born into slavery. Under the preaching of a man whose name was Richard Allen, he's the guy who founded the AME Church, she became converted. And in the context of her conversion, she stood to her feet and gave her testimony. So significant were her thoughts and her presentation that Richard Allen invited her to come back the next Sunday and bring the message. And so this woman born into slavery, this woman who had been subjected to all kinds of indignities, became one of the very first Methodist evangelists in the early 19th century. She traveled to Detroit. Think about that. Cincinnati, up and down the Atlantic seaboard, Philadelphia, as far as Canada. And she traveled there by invitation to proclaim the gospel of Jesus. And may I remind you that she did all of that while slavery was still legal in the United States of America. In 1869, there was a woman, his name was Margaret Von Kott. Household term, right? And she was the deacon in a little church in upstate New York. And after a while, she petitioned the conference there to grant her a local preacher's license. Well, in Methodism, you know, we have all kinds of levels of things. And the local preacher level is the very first level that you perceive going on to the ministry. It took her 7.5 years. 7.5 years to be given permission to pursue the local preacher's license. She completed the work in less than a year. And she became the first woman to be officially recognized in some vocational context by the Methodist Church. Think about that. 1869, first woman. Which then, of course, brings us to the 20th century. What time does this close? 10:45? Okay. Which brings us to the 20th century. Gordon Harland has written this indicting comment about my denomination. He says that while there were numerous women who did unbelievably significant work in the life of Methodism, beginning in the late 18th century up through the end of the 19th century, it wasn't until the 20th century in America that we begin to see some recognition of those women. And perhaps the first point of recognition occurred in 1956. Can you imagine that? 1956 was the first real recognition of women clergy. But be careful, don't take too much hope in that. Because it was a right to receive ordination. However, it did not include the right and privilege of connection. Now, those are in-house silly jargon terms, but what they mean is this. At this point in 1956, the Methodist Church was willing to put their hands on women's heads and say, "You are now an ordained pastor in the church." Connection means that they were not a part of the appointed system. So there was nowhere for them to go. It was kind of the old concept, one hand giveth, the other hand taketh. So due to pressure that was coming from all kinds of social awareness across the denomination, we finally ordained a woman into the full rights of an elder. However, we did not grant her full connection, so that while she had the credential, she had nowhere to go with it. And it wasn't until 1968. Think about that. Think about what was going on in our country in 1968. A Vietnam War, racial violence, all kinds of social uneasiness. It wasn't until that year that the right of full connection was granted to women. And statistically, in that year, there were 97 is the number I remember, 97 women who were appointed. Of those 97 women, 90 of them were appointed to assistantships, associate pastors, and the remainder served in some missionary capacity. To show you that what's changed, now we estimate that there are over 200,000 women serving in United Methodist churches of significant size and responsibility. But it took us all those years to get to that point. It wasn't until 1980 that we consecrated Marjorie Matthews to be the first Methodist bishop. She was a forward-thinking, bright, competent woman. And she was elected to that office by 5 votes. Today in the Methodist Church, we have a significant number of women ordained in the full connection. We have numerous women. In fact, in Western Pennsylvania now, our current bishop is a woman. But there is still an anxiety level that continues to permeate. That's a little bit of history about where we've been. And I think it's important now to take that history over the next 3 weeks and begin to try to take a look at what kind of an impact that history has had. I sent to Sarah, and I think you may have published, what we're going to be looking at over the next 3 weeks are 3 individual lives. The first one is Rosa Parks. Rosa Parks is the lady that said, "I'm sorry, I'm not going to go to the back of the bus. Do whatever you have to do, but I'm not going back." What you need to understand about Rosa Parks is that she comes out of a strong, significant faith background. And more importantly than that, Rosa Parks was not content to just be religious, to be as Phil Wilson used to talk about, the church lady. She took the reality of the gospel into one of the most contentious arenas of public debate of her time. So next week, we're going to take a look at this woman who, by the way, was just a secretary, but went on to be a national icon, really. The second person we're going to look at is Mother Teresa. I hope you all come back for that one. Because Mother Teresa has taught the world a couple of things. Number one, she's taught us the importance of a vow. You know, when she was originally sent to Calcutta to work with the poor, she lived in the convent. And her vow had been to care for the sick and the poor. But this is how that got done. All day long, she would be down in the streets of Calcutta, passing out all sorts of medicines and food, etc. And then when the day was over, she would return back to the convent. And there she would enjoy a nice warm supper, a pleasant bath, a private bed, and comforts. That went on for several years as Mother Teresa thought about her vow. And one day she went to her mother superior and said, "I have a request. I would like to live with the poor." And so went all the way to the Vatican and then all the way back. And she was given permission to leave the convent and live with, on the street, the poor. And to just give you a little preview of what that meant was, she scrubbed her teeth with ashes. She ate what the poor ate. Her quarters were a small room in which there was a table. And that table served as the dinner table, the altar table, the prayer table, and her sleep table. Mother Teresa has taught us all what it means to take a vow. And here's the other thing I'll talk about. She talks about what it is like to live within an institution that you may disagree with. You may remember that she was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. And upon learning of that, the Vatican called her and wanted to know when she was going to send the check. She gave her apologies and said that the check had already been spent on building some housing for young women who were having babies. And yet she stayed within the institution. And perhaps part of the reason for that is Mother Teresa teaches us about what it means to believe in Jesus. Mother Teresa made a vow once. She made it to Jesus. Jesus, she said, if you go with me, I will go anywhere. In the last years of her life, she shared with her official biography, Catherine Spinks, how it was that across that journey that she had made, every now and then this was her recurring question. Where's Jesus? Acknowledging her frustrations, her concerns, etc. And then the last woman we're going to look at is Rosemary Ruther. Rosemary Ruther is a Catholic theologian with a strong emphasis upon women's issues. And I think she has brought to the attention of all of us an important question. What is sexism? Is it a social issue? Perhaps. Is it a moral question? Could be. But Rosemary Ruther says this: sexism, like racism, is a sin because it is the violation of one of God's creation and the dignity of that creation. Yes, it's a social question. She writes it clearly. Yes, it's a moral question. But it's a matter of faith for her. And we'll talk a little bit about how it was that this woman's ultimate positions were shaped by a single mom who saw to it that she learned about other faith traditions, and by her uncle who was Jewish, who shared with her what it was like to be a Jew in an anti-Semitic culture. What it was like for her as a Catholic to go to a Protestant seminary. Indeed, shaping this rather significant woman. So that's my plan to move forward as we look at women in the faith community. And now maybe you'll have some questions or comments before we terminate. Anybody? Why not? Raise some. Yes, please, sir. I think it was about the same time we did, too.
I thought it was 69, perhaps.
Yeah, somewhere in that 50 to 60 decade area. But I think you folks were ahead of us.
Yeah.
You really were. I think you saw the... don't you remember Gail Buchwalter King? Yeah, okay. I knew Gail back in the 60s, whenever we were trying to do some things with an ecumenical approach to higher education. And then, of course, she was with you. And, of course, beyond that, she was the director of the American Theological Society here in Pittsburgh. And she was a very lone voice. I sat in many a meeting with Gail when she was the only woman present. And I was aware that there were some guys that didn't particularly like that idea. Okay, so I think that your question is best answered by saying, I think the Presbyterian Church was a bit more forward-thinking in terms of capitalizing on and utilizing primarily women clergy. And, you know, the other thing about the question of ordaining women, I don't think that's the only question. What roles do women have in local churches? Obviously, that's changing significantly. But there was a time when you didn't find a woman on the board of trustees. I remember while serving the First Methodist Church of Greensburg during the 80s, one evening we were passing out the financial report, and the man who was the chair was passing them about, and he got to a woman and he said, "Oh, you don't need one. You don't understand anyway." So it's only been within the last, 30 or 40 years, I think, that we've begun to realize, it sounds a bit silly, but I think it's true, that women have ability. Their sole function is not to teach the fourth graders or to make the pies and the cakes, but that indeed they have lived experience. And there's a, are you familiar with the whole concept of neuroscience? Yeah, try to read a little bit about that. It's an interesting concept. Neuroscience looks at the relationship between what we are as people, persons, and the kinds of genetic packages we possess. And this isn't done by new age people. These are responsible scientists, geneticists, behavioral people. And one of the things we're learning is that in the context of what the church does, there seems to be a strength in femininity that enhances the caring, nurturing notion of the church very much in the tradition of what was normally called the role of the pastor. So it's kind of a... When I talk to people my age, lots of times I hear these kinds of things. Oh, everything's changed, and it's not any good, and we're hopeless. I don't think so. I think we're living in a very exciting time when everything I've tried to share with you this morning, beginning back there with Sarah, right up through Marjorie Matthews being consecrated as a bishop, provide for us an enormous opportunity to move even more forward. And unfortunately, my denomination is not doing a very good job about that right now. But I think it's so exciting to be a part of the age in which we're living. And when you talk to young female students, is the way I'll describe it, I'll tell you something. It's one of the most exciting conversations you're going to have. They're going to be doctors. They're going to be lawyers. They're going to be jet pilots. And 40 years ago, probably that was totally unthinkable. So it is changing. And my hope in this class will be to show not only what the three people have done, but what it is that based upon that foundation, we will be able to continue to do and expand. Because it's not about yesterday. It's not even about today. It's about tomorrow and moving forward. Anyone else before we... Yes, please.
I have something I'm going to take home and think about. I'm not sure it's a question or a comment, but just bouncing off what you just said, where's the place of the mother? The woman who is the jet pilot, the lawyer that goes right into medical school, has she precluded that vocation of mother? Is that now to somebody else of a lower intellect, a lower class, to mother, and to be that person to Luther that his wife was, to be part of a partnership? That's just a wonder. I don't know if that's a comment or a question.
It's a good question.
I wonder about that.
I'm going to attempt to respond to that by using some things the Dalai Lama says. You all know about the Dalai Lama? He's over there in India. One of the things he talks about is this. In terms of vocation, which by the way comes from what? The Latin word vocare, which means to call. And historically, how have we understood that? Clergy. And every time you talk about vocation or calledness, clergy. We're kind of breaking through that. He writes that in terms of vocation, it is not what you do. It is how you do it. And I think you can take that bit of insight and apply it to your question. I'm not so sure that every woman who becomes a doctor necessarily becomes a good doctor. Conversely, I think we need to desperately realize that there is no shame or expression of incompetence in a woman who understands her vocation in terms of raising her children and, as you say, being a spouse. Particularly whenever those roles are not thought of by anybody in the family as being inferior. We have a daughter, and she is she's in her early 50s, and she's had a very checkered work experience. You know, she tried the health fields for a while, and she did that okay. She worked for the Boy Scouts of America for a while, and then she married. And she and her husband have made a decision that the three children they have are important enough for her to make that her vocation. They've made that choice together. We have three grandkids. I'm a wee bit proud, to talk about them. But we got three grandkids right now. One's 19, and he's a smart kid. You know why? He's actually chosen to come to St. Vincent's where I teach. I think that shows enormous insight on this kid's part. Number two, we have one 16, and then we have one 14. The two older boys, they recently purchased a truck and a trailer, as well as a zero-turn mower, and they're out there doing okay. What's interesting to me about it is, in talking with our daughter the other day, so what'd you do yesterday, honey? Oh, she said, I put on my work boots and I went with the boys and helped them in the yard. And when you see how those boys relate to their mother, you know that that time was well spent. And she homeschools. Yeah, she homeschooled them all. And, you know, I have to say, we're kind of the editors for all the papers that get written, you know. Grammy and Pap, how about checking this over and see what you think kind of thing. It's amazing what these kids know. And to her credit, the middle one is pretty much into science. And it came time for him to take advanced chemistry and anatomy. Our daughter said, that's out of my level of competence. And so he went to the public school to take those courses. So to answer your question, I think it's terribly relevant that we understand that that there is more than one avenue by which a woman's abilities and dignity and influence can be pursued.
It's all about having the choice.
Sure.
It's the choice of that pursuit.
Absolutely.
And then it's up to us to make sure that we don't misinterpret somebody's choice as a negative.
Exactly. Please.
There are public policy issues as well here, because the idea of maternity is one that's sort of hanging around right now. And for women in the workplace, I mean, that should be, I mean, all other developed countries have that as a given. We're working on that, I guess. So, I mean, there are things, and there are other issues such as shared time and so forth that make it easier for women to do, you know, to do both things. So I think public policy, also childcare is another thing. There are lots of women who would love to have a job, but they can't because there's no way for them.
It's too expensive.
To have childcare. So there are public policy issues that need to be looked at.
And to come back to your comment, I think that when you talk about choice, in my world, you're also talking about the issue of community. And I think that community always supports a person's right to choose. But beyond that, I think a community has to support once the choice has made. I think I must be getting a little senile because I keep returning back to some things that I once read. John Donne once said, what? No man is an island. Now, unfortunately, he uses a sexist pronoun there, noun there. But I think the point is obvious. And one of the sadnesses I see in our community today is that we are increasingly living in these silos where we don't really experience the meaning of community. I mean, think about it for just a moment. You don't have to leave your house anymore. You can shop, bank, pay bills, find a partner, and never leave your house. Now, I'm not here to make an anti-technical comment. I'm just here to say I worry about the fact that community matters and that we live in a time when too often we don't know each other. We have a young couple live beside us, and they have two little kids. And they are just nice people. And we're not back and forth. We're not in each other's house, that kind of thing. But we see each other. We talk to each other. Because the kids are out playing, and Rachel's out with the kids, and Scott's out there cutting his grass. At least sometimes he's out there cutting his grass. But what's been beautiful for me is this. The other day, Rachel said to me, anytime the kids hear a lawnmower, what they say is, Jack's cutting his grass. That's community. And conversely, whenever I'm out in the yard and I see a dog and I see those little kids out there, I make sure I get out there and make sure those kids are okay. You see what I'm saying about community? And I think that when we talk about women and the roles that they choose, how important it is for community to be supportive of that. And when we dial that back in terms of the church, we still have too much thinking that goes like this. I don't know about a woman preacher. Really? What would be your objection? Well, you know, their voice. I think the church needs to step up a little bit in terms of supporting. And I remember my dad, who was my father was the sexist of all sexists and the racist of all racists, but he was a good guy. I always say about my father, my dad objected to three things: prejudice, women, and blacks. But but they were assigned a woman pastor, and it was the good old boy club meeting back in the parlor. Her voice. My dad stepped up. He said, she can do the job. I think we need more of that. Sarah's standing up. I think it's time for me to shut up. See you next week, maybe, okay? Yeah.